And for the sermon, Mr. Steve Buchanan.
Note, starting the stopwatch. That will ensure, did you start yours too? Okay. That will ensure a timely finish. The leader of the Roman Catholic Church today is a man by the name of Pope Francis. Pope Francis was elected about 4 years ago. He was one of the oldest popes ever elected in the history of the Roman Catholic Church at the age of 76. There are some notable firsts associated with this pope. He's the first pope from South America. He's an Argentinian by birth. And what is he known for? From Wikipedia, it says, throughout his public life, Pope Francis has been noted for his humility, emphasis on God's mercy, concern for the poor, and commitment to interfaith dialogue. That means communicating with Protestant churches, with the Eastern Church. He's credited with having a less formal approach to the papacy than his predecessors. For instance, choosing to reside in the Dornus Sancte Marthae guest house rather than the papal apartments of the Apostolic Palace used by his predecessors. In addition, due to both his Jesuit and Ignatian aesthetic, he is known for favoring simpler vestments, void of ornamentation. Those are all the garb that the popes wear, including refusing the traditional papal Mozzetta cape upon his election, choosing silver instead of gold for his piscatory ring. I don't know what these terms mean, by the way, but I didn't want to bother looking them up. I didn't want to fill my head with useless information. Some of you former Catholics can chime in later in the chat. Okay, and keeping the same pectoral cross as he had as a cardinal, he maintains that the church should be more open and welcoming. He does not support unbridled capitalism, Marxism, or Marxist versions of libertarian theology. Francis maintains the traditional views of the church regarding social teaching, ordination of women, and supports taking action on climate change, a focus of his papacy with a promulgation of diplomacy. He helped restore full diplomatic relations between the United States and Cuba. Most people would consider his political views more socialist than anything else. He speaks softly when he speaks out. The Roman Catholic Church today comprises about half of all Christians in the world. Its membership is about 1.3 billion. So count another 1.3 billion for the rest of Christianity, and you've got the total sum of all Christians. And as you know, there's great emphasis now that this is the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation that began with Martin Luther. At the beginning of the 16th century, the Bible began to be distributed more widely than it had before, and actually read. And Martin Luther read the Bible, and he began to see that what the Bible said was in conflict with the traditions of the church. There was only one church. There was the Roman church. That was the only Christian church at the time. And Martin Luther was studying to be a monk in a monastery in Germany, where his days were spent fasting, praying, reading the Bible in Latin, and eventually he would be credited for translating the New Testament into German. First German translation of the New Testament. But I think it was raised last week in the chat that he was the one that raised the concern because the church was selling indulgences to absolve sin, which clearly wasn't in the Bible. But along with the rest of his famous 19 theses, his doctrines, his teachings would form the basis of modern Protestantism. So there are a list of questions that he hung on the door of the church, monastery, cathedral, castle in Germany that would be up for debate. Well, we know that Martin Luther had a great effect on modern society, had a great effect on the Protestant movement, which began with him. And most of us in this country, in the United States, if we had any church affiliation at all, it would be from one of those Protestant churches or the Catholic Church to begin with. Sometimes people were not so active in their Protestant or Catholic church. Sometimes they didn't really know what that church really taught. It was a matter of, I'm speaking of myself, it was a matter of tradition. It was a matter of going to church on a regular basis. You really didn't know why. I know. I remember my dad buying me a suit and said, well, you know, this is the first real suit. I was a teenager. I want you to go to church. And I was thinking, okay, you want me to go to church? Dad, are you going to church? No, I want you to go to church. And so I went to church. Went to the catechism classes on Wednesday nights at the Lutheran church. I don't really know why. It was a tradition. And most of us are anchored to tradition. We go to church. We don't really know why we go to that church or why we pick it. And then suddenly God enters your life and you figure all that stuff out. For all of his work, Martin Luther was excommunicated from the Catholic Church by Pope Leo X. And he was also declared a heretic. Now, they reviewed his writings for a couple of years. He had debates with other principal theologians of the day. He went to Rome. They debated his issues, and basically they concluded that you're wrong. You know, it doesn't really matter why. You're just wrong. You're a heretic. And that's basically how it was done. He was declared a heretic. He was booted out of the Roman Catholic Church, and he didn't really seem to be too offended by all of that. It wasn't really something that was all that important to him, at least from my study of history. On May 25th, 1521, the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, Charles V, also identified in, where is it? This chart, remember this? As Charles the Great. There may be some dispute about that because some people think that Justinian, the first emperor of the Holy Roman Empire in the 550s, was also Charles I. But besides that, Charles V declared him to be a... he ordered all of his writings to be burned. So they may have burned some of them. They didn't get all of them. They didn't get all the copies, apparently, because they survived. This would be the ancestor of the individual I spoke about last week, Otto von Habsburg. And he ruled over much of Europe, and very interesting. We're not covering him today in history, but he was the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, having been crowned by the Pope in 1520. So there was a concordant of church and state. There was a grouping together, and actually this was the fourth of the seven revivals that we spoke about last week during the sermon of the Holy Roman Empire. This is what history.com says about Martin Luther, just a couple of excerpts here. His central teachings, you can't argue with this, that the Bible is the central source of religious authority and that salvation is reached through faith and not deeds, shape the core of Protestantism. Although Luther was critical of the Catholic Church, he distanced himself from radical successors who took up his mantle. Luther is remembered as a controversial figure, not only because his writings led to significant religious reform and division, but also because in later life he took on radical positions on other questions, including his pronouncements against the Jews, which some have said may have portended German anti-Semitism. Others dismiss them as just one man's vitriol that did not gain a following. Some of Luther's most significant contributions to theological history, however, such as his insistence that as the sole source of religious authority, the Bible be translated and be made available to everyone, was truly revolutionary for his day. Imagine that. Here you have it in history.com, and something you probably already knew, that the church, which was the most powerful from the 300s AD up until that time, basically existed and enforced its own rules, regulations, dogma, apart from the written word of God, because it wasn't available to most people. And thanks to Gutenberg later on, with the invention of the printing press, man, the first thing they started churning out were copies of the Bible, and people began to read them, and then the Protestant movement was in full sway. No one could doubt, though, the very powerful influence of the Roman Catholic Church, which it exerts on a billion or so people around the globe, especially in Central and South America, that influence is very great. And as mentioned last week, maybe not so great in Europe today. Europe is very secular in nature. Europe is not very religious. Some people, those of us living in the United States, might say, the United States people are not very religious, but they're far more secular in Europe today. In other parts of the globe, maybe Christianity has a further grasp and other churches do. But relatively speaking, the church, Europe and everywhere in the world, and when I say church, I mean the Roman church, does not exert the kind of influence that the Bible speaks of a church exerting influence in the future. So in fact, you really can't point to anything. Just like I mentioned last week in Europe, you can't point to any singular event or things that are happening in Europe today that would guide you or lead you to believe that this super colossal mega nation group is going to arise on the world scene and dominate world affairs during the last few years before Christ's return. And in the same way, although it's powerful and it's obviously the richest church in the world and they have vast billions and billions and billions in holdings, probably one of the largest landowners in the entire world, the Roman Catholic Church, there's nothing to suggest that this church will exert the kind of power that the Bible shows that it will exert on all mankind in the future. Now, that influence is there, and I've often talked about my visit in 1975. Mr. Bishoner and I were both there. I don't know if you went the day that we went to the Church of Our Lady of the Guadalupe, which is surrounded by a massive square of cobblestones. I don't know, were you there that day? I don't know. We went. They have some tradition that there's a wall hanging or a picture that weeps, you know, with real tears or something. Anyway, I don't know, even know if I went in, but I remember that they have pilgrims from all over Central and South America that go to that Church of Our Lady of the Guadalupe. Now, this shows the powerful influence that it can have on people, and that traditions can have on people, but I don't know if any of you have ever walked on cobblestones. It's not very comfortable. Cobblestones are uneven, but, you know, they laid these cobblestones as paving for like hundreds of yards around this cathedral in Mexico City. And pilgrims, in this case, some young mothers, would get on their knees and crawl with babies in their arms for hundreds of yards to the cathedral. You know, that's a powerful influence, because by showing that kind of penitence, and apparently in their minds, by showing that kind of sacrifice, to the point to where after a while your knees get bloody. And in this case, the one that I saw specifically had wraps and wraps of gauze around her knees, and it's all red. The blood is bleeding through. That's a powerful influence on a couple of individuals. That day, I believe it was a Sunday morning in Mexico City, where people would make their pilgrimage to this particular church. And other religious shrine sites around the world, they've done similar things. The power and the influence that I'm speaking about today comes from the Bible, and it is going to far overshadow anything that anyone else could imagine, because today a little humble socialist reformer who believes in global warming and climate change is the head holds the title of Pope or the leader of the Catholic Church. But the Bible warns that something much more dramatic is going to happen to this church, to this leader of Christianity, possibly within our lifetimes. As we know, no guarantees on that one, but we have to be aware of what's happening. And this is the second pillar of end-time Bible prophecy. That now, I'm not putting these in any special order. They're just the order that I decided to choose them in. But this is the second of five that I'm going to be speaking on. The warnings in the Bible regarding these events will have a great deal to do in the future of the lives of people of the Church of God. The Bible gives a very clear view of these events that will accompany the arrival on the world scene of a powerful, we mentioned it last week, little horn. Little government. Little in comparison to the major power that is going to appear on the scene. Now there's something very important that is cited by Paul to the people of Thessalonica. And if you'll turn to the books of Thessalonica, he wrote two letters to the church at Thessalonica. And he covered three basic problems were covered in these two short letters to the people of Thessalonica, Greek city. Had you gone on the Greek tour this year, you probably would have gone there. There are some 250 or 60 people that went to the feast in Greece. But number one, they were encountering some persecution for their relatively newfound faith of Christianity from Jerusalem, from the beginnings and the origin of the New Testament church in 31 AD. Paul's message was one of comfort. So that was one of the number one things that he intended to cover, was to comfort those folks during a time of persecution. Whenever the truth goes out, and of course there wasn't this other church that we're talking about today on the scene, there was one Christian church. But already, as he indicates, there were various ideas and amalgamation of other ideas that began to be trying to gain a foothold into the true Church of God. Secondly, he warned some of those who were in the church, some of them apparently even lazy, maybe not even working as they could work, and they were able to work, but maybe because they thought that the time of the end was close by, they were becoming insubordinate to some degree and somewhat lazy. So he tells them to work with their own hands. And he had set the example of being a tent maker himself. And the third point is, he had to eliminate some of the confusion as to the end time, because Paul spoke, people were comforted, he left, and then various ideas began to filter in. So if you'll turn to 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 1, this shows what one of the concerns that they had was, this chapter. But concerning the times and the season, brethren, you have no need that I should write to you, for you yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night. A thief comes in the night when no one is expecting. But he also indicates that they would expect it. They would know what's going on, and he indicates this later on. For you yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night. For when they say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them as labor pains upon a pregnant woman, and they shall not escape. But you, brethren, are not in darkness, so that this day should overtake you as a thief. You are all sons of the light and sons of the day. We're not of the night nor of the darkness. So Paul had taught them during the time that he was there about the time of God's intervention in the affairs of mankind and that Christ would return. But apparently, some were spreading rumors and lies about the return of Jesus Christ. In verse 6, therefore, let us not sleep as others do, but let us watch and be sober. This terminology is talking about of course, not restful sleep and needed sleep or anything like that, but spiritual activity, being spiritually aware and not being asleep as everyone else. But let us watch and be sober. And as in Luke 21, the watching here has to do with being on your own guard, your own spiritual condition, your relationship with God. So we should never confuse that, because we can look for these events that are described in the Bible to happen. There won't be any doubt that they are happening to those who are on guard, but it's not just a matter of just physically watching. It's a matter of being spiritually aware. He continues on that theme in verse 7, "For those who sleep, sleep at night, and those who get drunk are drunk at night. But let us who are of the day be sober, putting on the breastplate of faith," using some of the very same terminology as in the book of Ephesians in chapter 6. "Let us put on the breastplate of faith and love, and as the helmet and as a helmet the hope of salvation. For God did not appoint us to wrath, but to obtain salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ, who died for us, that whether we wake or sleep, we should live together with him." So whether you're alive and present at the return of Jesus Christ, or you die and you fall asleep, so to speak, and you sleep in death, you'll still have salvation in Jesus Christ at his return. And that is emphasized as well. So, therefore, comfort each other and edify one another, just as you're also doing. And that's a warning to us as well in this time 2,000 years later, right? Now, in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, he begins to explain to them something that has very oftentimes been grossly misunderstood, but I don't think by you. But it has been very misunderstood by many people, even throughout history, even in recent history, some of this has been misunderstood. So beginning in verse 2, in chapter 2, 2 Thessalonians, "Now, brethren, concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and our gathering together to him, we ask you not to be soon shaken in mind or troubled, either by spirit or by word or by letter, as if from us, as though the day of Christ had come." So obviously somebody was planting some seeds and some rumors and some falsehoods even after the first letter was received. First letter comes, it's read to the church receives it, and then maybe some other false letters came, some false ideas came, days, months passed, we don't have instant communication like we do today. Some false ideas began to be promulgated. And it got back to Paul. Somebody wrote to him, obviously, and got back to Paul. And so he writes to address these new set of concerns that arose from the misguidance from somebody somewhere about the first letter that he wrote. "Let no one deceive you by any means, whether in person or by letter or anything else." So apparently somebody had circulated maybe a letter that they purported to be from Paul, that Christ had already returned. Now, that sounds crazy to us now because we have the whole of the Bible available to us. It wasn't all canon at that particular time. So they were confused. They'd been told in the first letter that the dead in Christ would rise first, and then those who were alive, but someone had gotten to them with some false information. So in 1 Thessalonians 4, remember, in verse 13, "I don't want you to be ignorant, brethren, concerning those who have fallen asleep, lest you sorrow as others who have no hope. For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so God will bring with him those who sleep in Jesus. For this we say to you by the word of the Lord, that we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord will by no means precede those who are asleep, for the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of an archangel, and with the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them, those that have already risen, in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And thus we shall always be with the Lord. It doesn't say, and thus we shall always be with the Lord in the air. We will be with the Lord. We will be with God. He's returning to the earth. That's where he's coming back. So other scriptures bring that out, as you know. So going back to 2 Thessalonians, after he says, don't let anybody deceive you, he says, for that day will not come, verse 3 in the middle, for that day will not come unless the falling away comes first. That's a prophecy of falling away. When does that happen? Has it happened? Will it happen again? Well, I would say that if you're here in this church and if you're here sitting here, you're in a pretty safe place, but falling away is something that always has a future potential, right? And the Bible shows what can happen if people and how people fall away, how they depart from the faith, how they leave the faith, how they leave the Sabbath, leave the holy days, leave. And they depart from the faith. That day will not come first, not come unless the falling away comes first, and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. So who is the man of sin? And how will we know when he is revealed? The Bible doesn't say exactly how he will be revealed. But I dare say that when you see the descriptor that the Bible gives of this individual and his potential and his power, you'll know. You'll know. The Bible is very clear as to what this individual is going to do, how he's going to do it, and for anyone that is listening to me, there should be no doubt or question when these things happen. You won't have to look for it. You won't have to speculate about it. You won't have to count out numbers, try to add up Roman numerals and names and stuff like that and come up with 666. Because that applies to the beast anyway. It doesn't say that it applies to the man of sin. But you won't have to do any of that. But just like Paul told the Thessalonians, you do not have to be shaken or confused. So let's take a look at this man of sin. According to Paul, it leaves very little to the imagination. Number one, he is the son of perdition, which means he's the son of hell, the son of damnation, destruction, and damnation. Number two, he opposes and exalts himself above God or anything that is worshipped as God. It doesn't apply to Pope Francis. Apparently, still a very powerful, no doubt about it, individual who is over a large church, a group of a billion or so people, practicing, non-practicing. He's not this. He doesn't fit this descriptor. He's not this at all. When this appears on the scene, there's not going to be any doubt. Three, he sits as God, claiming to be God, in the temple of God, showing himself as God, God incarnate, this human being. So what he does is going to be astounding. And it is going to grab attention to the extent that there will be little doubt whatsoever to the entire world. So, yeah, 4 years ago, Pope Francis was selected as cardinal. Many thousands of people gathered in the Vatican Square in the rain, waiting for the announcement, waiting for the puff of smoke. the election of the cardinals to be finished, and the whole world kind of watched, really, because this is an important event that affects the lives of not only the billion Catholics or so, but everywhere where there's a Catholic church, and that's virtually all over the world. The proclaiming or the professing Catholics, now they may not, you know, their churches may be like vacant most of the time. I'm sure in some Sundays here, the Catholic Church are probably filled, right? And a lot of people go to them. But in Europe, not so much. Probably the cathedrals, many of them are empty even on a Sunday. But still an important individual, because he sets the tone for all the rest of the Catholic Church. And if you'll notice that through the years, maybe with the possible exception of Pope John Paul II, who was truly charismatic, and again, a very peaceful individual, and it was interesting that he and Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, all came upon the scene at the same time, kind of worked together to halt the spread of communism. A Polish pope whose country had been overcome by the communist regime since World War II, the end of World War II, and he kind of fought against all of that at the same time that Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan were fighting against, and they all kind of, all their influence exerted during the 8 to 10 years that they're all in power was pretty powerful. But in this sense, it was kind of powerful in a good way, because it brought Germany together, knocked down a wall that had separated people since World War II, the end of World War II. And I think you could probably say they, all three of them, did a pretty good job and did some good things during the 80s for humanity. So we've got a little socialist that is in charge of these billion people, and he's got his pronouncements about global warming and carbon credits and, I don't know, whatever else is his pet idea. Nobody really pays that much attention to it. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 5, do you not remember that when I was with you, I told you these things? I told you. We talked about it. And now you know what is restraining that he, that is, this man of sin, this son of perdition, this son of damnation and hell. Now you know what's restraining that he may be revealed in his own time. There's restraint. It's going to happen at its appointed time. It's going to happen when God allows it to happen. It's going to happen at the right time and in the future. But then he goes on to say that the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. So yeah, the mystery of lawlessness had been around for a long time. In fact, it had been around since the ancient Tower of Babel began to be erected. So it's already at work. In fact, it's been at work since the Garden of Eden. The mystery of lawlessness, you know, this whole, you know, they called it the Babylonian mystery religion. Just like before Luther came along, so much of the religion was based on mystery and dogma and not really revelation from God. It was tradition and goes all the way back to Babylon. And so that, you know, I don't know that Luther ever wrote about Easter. It's not in the Bible. I don't think he ever did. Or Christmas, not in the Bible. But it descends. Both holidays descend from this mystery of lawlessness, this iniquity that goes all the way back. All of the customs, the traditions, not found in the Bible, found in secular history and pagan tradition, rooted in the false religions of mankind that have existed since that time. It's already at work. Only he, that is God, only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way. So the evil work, another translation, the New Testament translation. But the evil work, the evil work is held in check and will be held back until the time when he who now restrains will set aside. The time will be right, some point in the future. This person will come on the scene, will become the leader of a great church that's based in Europe. So the power is great. Now, this individual gets his power from what Paul describes as the prince of the power of the air and spiritual wickedness in high places in Ephesians 2 and Ephesians 6. That power has always been there. The mystery of lawlessness is already at work. It's been there all along. It's just been under restraint until the time that God removes that restraint and allows it to come upon the world. So God has not allowed that power to just have free rein on the earth to do whatever it wants to do. It's been restrained. But it will no longer be restrained when the man of sin is revealed. Now notice in verse 8, then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. And if we have time, we'll go to that at the end of the sermon today and to Revelation 20. The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan with all powers, signs, and lying wonders. Nope. We've never seen that kind of power exist in an individual, where an individual would have this kind of satanic power. And with all unrighteous deception among those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved, and for this reason God will send them strong delusion, that they should believe the lie, that they all may be condemned who did not believe the truth but had pleasure in unrighteousness. Paul says that the whole world is delusional anyway. That mystery of lawlessness has been at work anyhow. This church entity has perpetuated those delusions for almost 2,000 years, and the Protestant Reformation kind of interrupted a little bit of that flow. And of course, they are called the daughters because they perpetuated many of the same false pagan traditions and believed in them, but there were some things that allowed the Bible to be preserved that maybe were good offshoots of the Protestant Reformation. And then the Bible began to be read and to be studied. And there were theologians who came along who studied the Bible and had maybe even a pretty good firm grasp of ancient history that enabled them to be able to understand what the Bible is saying. Some of them commented, and some of the things they came up with are pretty good. Sometimes you have to sift through a lot of nonsense and false thinking to get to something that might be a little gem or a little nugget. But sometimes they have some insight. We had those individuals come along. Paul says that when he was with them, he told them these things anyway. He says, "You know, don't you remember? I told you about all of this when I were with you." Now, there's a famous prophecy. This is one of the basis of what Paul got his information from in the book of Daniel in chapter 9. Now, I know that this is a big-time review for many in our audience and many that are watching in. You know, I'm sure that you don't have time to study these things every day or every week. But in Daniel 9, there's a prophecy that is called the 70 weeks prophecy. And it reveals a little bit about the man of sin and about the time of the end. It also reveals quite a lot about the timing and the appearance of Christ on the scene in 4 AD, thereabouts. And then it speaks about that and being cut off. And it has a lot to do with that. And it, you know, gives us a lot of glimpse. We're not going to go through all of that today, but in verse 26, It says this, and this is relative to the topic that we're speaking about today, which is the rise of the false church. That's the title. For those of you that like titles, the rise of the false church. When does it happen? We don't know. But we do know the signs that are going to accompany it, and that's not really a mystery to us. But in this 70 weeks prophecy, it says, after the 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off. That happened in 31 AD, but not for himself. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end of it shall be with a flood until the end of the war, desolations are determined. Then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. But in the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to the sacrifice and offering. And on the wing of abomination shall be one who makes desolate, even until the consummation which is determined is poured out on the desolate. The city and the sanctuary would be destroyed. Daniel 8 also shows a glimpse of this man of sin. Daniel 8 and verse 11. He exalted himself as high priest, as the prince of the host. And by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth down to the ground. He did all this and prospered. Now, this is a glimpse of what this man of sin in the future will do. And in Daniel 11, there's an associated prophecy as well, beginning in verse 31, we'll read. This had an ancient fulfillment. This prophecy was fulfilled, from our perspective, historically, in about 168 BC, with a Greek leader this time, who was of the Greek Empire, the third of the four major world ruling empires, the Greek, and this was one of the four parts of Alexander's kingdom that had been split up. But it says, his forces and forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there an abomination of desolation. So there was a temple that was still extant in Jerusalem at this particular time. The Greek leader was Antiochus Epiphanes, very powerful man, moved to Jerusalem, ended the daily sacrifices of the Jews, put up a statue of Jupiter into the Holy of Holies, and took over. That is the historical fulfillment of this particular prophecy, but Daniel wrote about it 500 years ahead of time, as we know. Goes on, it says, those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery, but the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. So a future group of people of God will do great things during the time of the end, very apparently. But this prophecy is a forerunner of what's going to happen when we spoke about the beast power last week, what it is going to do in the future. Verse 33. And those of the people who understand shall instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. And there were those who rebelled against this Greek power that did that very same thing, the Jews at that particular time, the Maccabees. The Maccabees fought against the Greek forces, and eventually they were defeated. But in Luke chapter 21, the end time fulfillment of this particular prophecy is mentioned in the book of Luke in chapter 21 and verse 20. I think we may have spoken about this or may have chatted about this in the messenger chat last week. In Luke chapter 21 and in verse 20, but when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that the desolation is near. Now, it had been 200 years earlier that Jerusalem had been surrounded by armies. And that was well known in the Jewish history of the day in 31 AD when Christ came to the Temple Mount. And he told them that to his disciples, when they asked about, you know, when are these things going to happen? When is the time of the end? He said, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, let those who are in the midst of her depart. And there was another fulfillment of this particular prophecy. In 69 AD, Roman armies went to Jerusalem once again, led by one of their generals, Cestius. And they marched on Jerusalem. Now, I think it is Josephus that records that that army got within the sight of the walls of Jerusalem. And then, for some unknown reason, just stayed there. But according to Josephus, the individuals who were members of the church fled the scene. And by 70 AD, Jerusalem was sacked. And the lore in the history is that 1 million Jews or more were killed by the Roman armies. Now, the prophecies of Daniel and the gospel accounts make it clear that daily sacrifices of some kind will exist, and there will be some kind of temple at a future point that is established in Jerusalem once again. There isn't a temple now. The most sacred area in Jerusalem is the Wailing Wall. That's where Jews gather to pray. Prophecy indicates, indeed, maybe a physical temple, but there's not one now. Now, there's been pushes for a temple to be built, but none have been built. But much like much of the rest of the world, Israel today is pretty secular, maybe more secular in some ways than even they have their religious groups, you know, and their far-right religious groups, of course. But most of the nation is pretty secular. Most of the nation doesn't really observe the Sabbath in a rigorous way. But Bible prophecy indicates that times will get tough. And we'll cover that in another future sermon about the Middle East. But the indication is that those daily sacrifices will be reinstituted. And this beast power that we spoke about last week is going to cause those daily sacrifices to cease. And the one that Paul calls in Thessalonica to the Thessalonians, the man of sin, will then place himself into the temple in a similar way as Antiochus Epiphanes did anciently, and then proclaim himself to be God. That's the way it looks from all indications that that will happen. But we see nothing on the scene now to suggest that it will happen. So you either believe it, you read it in the Bible, and I don't think it's an interpretation that we kind of came up with, but you can't really project it from what's happening in the world today. Back to the book of Daniel, chapter 12. Daniel 12 and verse 9. He said, go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed to the time of the end. Many shall be purified, made white and refined, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. And from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away, and the abomination of desolation is set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Okay, you know what we're not going to do today? Is we're not going to do any reverse engineering and try to figure out when this happens. How many times has that happened in our history? Reverse engineering, count backwards, 1,290, 1,260, 30-day difference. What does it all mean? Not going to go there. You know, you're not going to have to know there. You don't have to understand perfect times and counting. If you're there in the moment, if you're close to God, if you're spiritually aware, believe me, that's what you need. You're not going to be, I better flee Jerusalem now. Hey, that's not your salvation. Salvation is a gift. Salvation is a spiritual thing. It's not a physical thing at all where you're calculating and doing all this. So we've got 1,290 days. There's a blessing pronounced on those who waits and comes to the 1,335 days. That's 45 days earlier. So I know what Mr. Armstrong said at one time about that, but I'm not going to share it with you in the sermon because it was speculation. I don't mean it's wrong, but it was speculation. But it doesn't really help you at all. It doesn't help you to understand what's going to appear upon the world scene. Now, in Book of Revelation in chapter 13, we kind of briefly touched on that, and we'll briefly touch on it today. Revelation 13 talks about this same man of sin, the same religious ruler. In verse 11, I saw another beast. Remember, beast is a synonym for government, because that's the way the nations of the world generally are categorized by God. The nations of the world are like jackals. They're like beasts. And in times of stress and war, they tend to act beastly, ghastly, horrible. Just go back to any recent war or any past war and take a look at, okay, hopefully this doesn't offend anyone, the Gentile nations, how they treat others, how they treat the nations of Israel, how they have been. Ghastly, horrible. So this beast, this government, comes up from out of the earth. It has two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. It appears to be a representative of the God of heaven, of Jesus Christ, but it's actually a representative of Satan. And he exercises all the authority of the first beast, which is that, shall I say it, that super, colossal, United States of Europe, which we don't see now. It's a representative of that power that we spoke about last week, and he's exercising all that authority. You know, anciently speaking, the popes were like generals. They had their own armies. They went to war. That's what this one does. He goes to war. He directs the war-making efforts of this first beast and causes the earth and all who dwell in it to worship, to be a part of that system. You have to worship it. Just as Nebuchadnezzar commanded all of his subjects to worship his own image that he set up, and you will bow down or you will be beheaded or you'll be thrown into a furnace. Nope, God's people said no. And they weren't burned up, as we know. He performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. This is what Paul, 30 years earlier, had told the Thessalonians to expect of a man of sin. Somebody that has this kind of miraculous or this superhuman power, this otherworldly power. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast which was wounded by the sword and lived. And that wound happened thousands of years ago. The fall of the Holy Roman Empire, 476 AD. And that wound was later healed with Justinian the Great. And a Holy Roman Empire began, and successive kingdoms leading up to the last one. We're almost there. The last one, the last revival of this Holy Roman Empire is what this is speaking about. And it's going to be a combination of church and state. He was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. That's where, not taking the time, you go back and read for yourself Revelation 12. Revelation 12 is a story about Israel, the true church of God, Jesus Christ. The followers of Jesus Christ are not going to be bowing down to this image, to this beast, and not going to worship it. Some of them will be martyred. That's what the Bible tells us. So, that is the activity of this particular beast, this man of sin, man of damnation, man of hell, whose purpose and activity is to persuade the people of the earth to worship the first beast whose fatal wound was healed. And he does that by great signs. You can't underestimate this power. It doesn't exist today. First Timothy. So it's kind of hard, except for the written word, for us to imagine, because there's never been anything like it on this earth. In 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 1, it says, "Now the Spirit expressly says that in latter times some will depart from the faith." Yep, probably prior to all of this happening, "giving heed to deceiving spirits and doctrines of demons." That's what emanates from all of these other churches. One half of the Christian church, Protestant, the other half Roman Catholic. Some truth mixed in with a lot of babble, a lot of error, a lot of tradition, a lot of phony, stupid stuff that doesn't make any sense, but people, that's good stuff. That's good. Yeah, it's good for the children. It's like, their doctrines of demons, speaking lies in hypocrisy, having their own conscience seared with a hot iron, forbidding to marry. That was one of the things that Martin Luther railed against, by the way. Martin Luther objected to the church's tradition of the clerics being celibate and not marrying, because it wasn't in the Bible. Martin Luther eventually married, and then later on in life he kind of went a little crazy. He stopped being the leader of a... He started a movement that he was never a leader of, is basically what happened. Luther started this rebellion against the Catholic Church, was excommunicated, stood firm to his ground, and then basically kind of drifted away. But he had a tremendous influence. Then he a little wacky with his ideas about the Jews, and then believed in polygamy later on in life. Now, I don't think he ever practiced it, but he looked to the Bible. You know, here he read the Bible, saw the mistakes and the sins of, you know, of some in the Bible. He said, well, it was good for them, it's good for us, much like the, 150 years ago, another church in the United States believed in polygamy too. Some people say they still do. Anyway, I don't know. Paul also said that this mystery of lawlessness was already at work, but it will be so powerful in the time of the end that the deception will be so great, even some, perhaps, who knew the truth will depart from the truth and believe these lies. So, in Revelation chapter 16, Revelation 16, in verse 13, John says, "I saw three unclean spirits like frogs coming out of the mouth of the dragon." Out of the mouth of the beast and out of the mouth of the false prophet. So emanating from Satan, from the beast, these are individuals, these are humans, and this man of sin, evil, wretched, horrible, foul spirits. These are the spirits of demons performing signs which go out to the kings of the earth and of the whole world to gather them to the battle of that great day of God Almighty. They'll be led to Jerusalem. "Behold, I am coming as a thief. Blessed is he who watches and keeps his garments, lest he walk naked and they see his shame." There's a time of great spiritual darkness that will in the future descend upon mankind. It's not here yet. We've got pope that is powerful, but not like the power it's spoken of here, and you can read for yourself. I've left out a lot. Revelation 17, we covered a little bit of that last week. You can cover that on your own. We aren't told how this individual is going to be revealed. It may be innocuous. It may be just as simple as just having another election and then waiting for that individual to become this man of sin. A little puff of smoke, new pope is announced at some point. Don't expect it tomorrow. Don't expect it for maybe a while. But the crimes they commit against God and mankind will be so grave and so heinous. The book of Revelation shows, we talked about this last week, they're cast into the lake of fire. The lake of fire is not a physical place. This is the place of eternal death. That's how great their sin is. There's no recovery for these two. So, brethren, when will this false church arise? It's already here. It's already here. It's in its infancy. Paul said that mystery was already at work. It's been around for a long time. It comes from ancient Babylon with all of its sordid traditions and ungodly accoutrement. But you might say right now that it lies in dormancy. It's a good thing. Time to prepare. Time to get ready. Time to be spiritually alert. The rise of the false church is one of the five major pillars of end time prophecy that I mentioned last week, that if you know them, you've got pretty good basis of knowledge, but that's not alone going to protect you. You'll be aware. But simply knowing isn't going to protect anybody from deception. Only God and His Holy Spirit can protect anyone from the rise of this false church, its false doctrine, its false religion, and the sway that it will hold over all of mankind.